91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today's program begins with the fascinating ways in which popular sports have evolved into their present forms. Good afternoon, it's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. Former ESPN The Magazine editor-in-chief Gary Belsky is the co-author of The Origins of Sports. The original rules of common games are strange, like no dribbling in basketball, a gridiron center could kick the ball backwards instead of snapping it. Today's home run blast could have been fouls. That's coming up in minutes. Also this hour is resident chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gassenheimer. We'll discuss the invasive and venomous lionfish. It seems the best way to stop lionfish from hurting native fish is for humans to dine on them. Topical Currents up next, after the news.
And a very upbeat beginning to today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman with you. Well, we begin today's program with a look at some of the oddities in our favorite sports. There are many terms and rules from bygone days which are still used. Take home plate in baseball. Like the one on your table, it was originally round.
Or golf. An original rule states that any stray bones on the fairway can't be moved aside. Sort of ghoulish. And there are plenty of interesting facets in American football history as well.
Such as a center's option to kick the ball backward to a runner at a play's start or something like that. So we'll learn more from Gary Belsky.
He's the co-author with Neil Fine of On the Origin of Sports, the Early History and Original Rules of Everybody's Favorite Games.
Gary Belsky is the former editor-in-chief of ESPN The Magazine, and he joins us now on the phone.
Welcome.
Bones on the fairway.
Yeah, watch out for those.
One of the things you realize when you do a book about the history of sports and the sort of original rules or the rules that launched the game as we would recognize it is that it was actually a challenge we had in annotating all of the rules that we published. Is very often these rules were being written for people, A, who were already very familiar with the game that they were playing, and so half of the things you might want to explain if you were going to explain it to a Martian or somebody from America, they don't think to explain because everybody was playing cricket. So we don't have to explain, you know, half the rules. And the other issue is that it's very clear that they were addressing problems or commonalities of behavior. So, you know, there might be bones on a golf course in Scotland when you're, you know, when they were often being played. You know, obviously golf has its origins in sheep meadows and sheep pastures, and so there would often be, you know, bones or lying around, and that's the reason for a lot of the idiosyncratic nature of the different rules that we looked at and talked about.
Now, wait, I just want to start because you profiled 21 sports in your book.
Yes,
a
ma'am.
Few of which challenged my understanding of what qualifies as a sport. Yes, like ultimate and like let's see, what's
poker.
And
fantasy,
what about
football?
Fantasy football, exactly. You're taking the words out of my mouth. So how did you decide what to include here?
Well, you know, I no longer work for ESPN, but I did for 14 years, and I'm a loyal ex-employee. The argument could be made that if ESPN broadcasts it, it's a sport.
Okay.
I can't imagine anybody would have any issue with ultimate frisbee. I mean, it's very much a sport by any definition. It's not the largest sport in the world, but it's played by millions of people across the globe in a competitive way. There are leagues. There's money being played for it. You know, I just was interviewed in a story that was published in Newsweek, in which the writer was actually trying to sort of answer what is a sport, and he made a couple of interesting observations. Obviously, it's got to be physical. One of the arguments against, for example, a sport like golf as being considered a sport as opposed to a competition is that sports should require you to be able to play defense, right? That somebody could actually stop you from doing the thing that you're doing, mm-hmm. which would, you know, eliminate golf. And I'm not sure anybody thinks golf isn't a sport. Poker requires actually, it's definitely a competition, obviously, but it also requires a great deal of stamina, requires a great deal of focus, very similar to NASCAR, for example. It is physical poker in its own way and intellectual in the same way that when you work at a sports brand and you talk to race car drivers, they will often tell you that their careers took off when they started to work out, because they started to be able to sort of handle the steering wheel better, they started to be able to focus better, they started to be able to kind of drive as hard as they possibly could. So, you know, in the end, it's just sports and games, so we were comfortable putting pastimes in, like fantasy sports, for example. And in the end, you know, it was our book, so we got to do what we wanted to do.
That's a good answer.
Okay, let's get back to this business that we referred to in the opening, this business in American football where the center would have a choice of being able to kick the ball backwards to a runner or a quarterback instead of snapping it.
Yeah, well, remember that, you know, football, American football, was essentially a descendant of rugby. And if you watch a rugby game, you will often see that's exactly what will happen sometimes in a scrum, as the line of scrimmage in football descended from the scrum in rugby. And it was just a vestige from the first 30 or 40 years of American football, which could be argued in America were the last 30 or 40 years of rugby. This is in the late 1800s. We, in fact, decided, there was a big debate between Neil Fine, my partner, and I about what rules to mark as the beginning of modern American football as we know it, because the line of scrimmage, which is basically the idea that you stop, you reset the play at a particular yard marker, and then you start again, had been in force in American football / rugby from about 1870. But we decided to use the forward pass introduction, which mm-hmm. happened in 1906. And the great thing about this book in general is just how often the things we looked at historically end up being relevant today. So the reason for the introduction of the forward pass in football was because in 1905, 19 or 20 players in high school and college died from injuries incurred on the football field, basically from concussions and broken skulls. And there was calls to ban the sport because it was thought to be too dangerous and too bloodthirsty and too violent. And Teddy Roosevelt, of all people, the president, who was a big, you know, fan of muscular Christianity, he basically convened the heads of the powerhouse football teams at the time, which were Princeton, Yale, and Harvard, and said, you guys need to fix this. You have to figure this out. And so they introduced a gimmick play that would spread the field, and that gimmick play was the forward pass. But 110 years later, we're still having arguments about football and concussions. So the more things change, the more they stay the same.
You just mentioned that muscular Christianity. For our listeners who may not know what that is, would you explain what that was, please?
Yeah, sorry. You know, sometimes I can get in my own head. Muscular Christianity was, remember that in the 1800s, the general idea was that if you had a suntan or you had muscles, you were poor because you were working outside and you were spending a lot of your day lifting heavy things. So clearly you were poor. And there was a general feeling in England and among sort of upper class or intellectual Westerners that this was not necessarily good for the soul. You know, these were early mind-body proponents, and this was partially responsible for the invention of the Young Men's Christians Association movement, which, you know, YMCA is as it's known. And YMCA started in England, and it was basically this idea that we need to get the elites to sort of be a little bit more physical because it'll make their spirits better, which is the connection to, you know, the Christianity part. And Roosevelt, who you guys know, I'm sure, was, you know, sort of a sickly, ill child, was, you know, benefited greatly from a focus on physical fitness in his youth. And so he believed very much that this was an important idea, and he saw football as a great expression of Americanism. But that's what muscular Christianity was, this idea that, like, people would be better Christians, more spiritual, more thoughtful if they were stronger Christians.
A lot of people just finished watching the NBA, of course. Now, you'd think watching that game, you'd wonder about the curious practice of the dribble, if you were, like you said, from outer space. Was the dribble in Naismith's first rules?
No, not at all. It was one of the great examples of early crowdsourcing. So when James Naismith, at a YMCA, by the way, speaking of muscular Christianity, when he invented basketball, which he did because he was ordered to by his boss, who needed an indoor activity in the late 1890s in very cold Springfield, Massachusetts during the winter. And Naismith went away, and it's one of the rare sports in which he was inventing it from whole cloth. People weren't playing any form of the game of basketball before James Naismith invented it one weekend. And he came back and instituted this game that had peach baskets, you know, nailed up. It's a familiar story, peach baskets nailed up on the inside track of a gymnasium, and he had a whole bunch of rules. One of them was that if you had the ball, you couldn't move. You had to stay where you caught the ball, stayed where you are, and you could either shoot or you could pass it to somebody else. One of the ways you could pass it to somebody else was to do a bounce pass, you know, to throw the ball to the ground and bounce it to somebody else. And that was how people played this very slow game for a couple of years. And then some players at Yale very cleverly thought, well, what if I bounce pass the ball to myself, leave it to an Ivy Leaguer to come up with a hack? And they started bounce passing the balls to themselves, and people very much liked that. It sped up the game and made it more interesting. Soon players realized they could bounce pass the ball to themselves with only one hand, and all of a sudden the dribble was part of the game, and everybody realized this makes the game better, and so it was adopted into the general practice of basketball, which spread incredibly quickly. I would say within 10 years, schools around the country, high schools, et cetera, and colleges were playing, you know, that early form of basketball by 1900, and given that the sport was only invented in 1892, if my memory serves me, that's an amazing early adoption rate.
We're speaking with Gary Beltsky about his book that he co-authored, On the Origins of Sports. Gary, in the finals of the NBA, in those seven games, was there ever a travel called?
Well, that's a whole different question. There are rules.
They're walking with that ball like crazy.
Exactly. Well, I think in general, to be honest with you, I think the travel call has morphed into being like, you know, that you basically have one extra step than what the rules say you do. And I think everybody sort of understands that. And the truth of the matter is, it's one of the rare instances. I think they're pretty consistent about that both ways. And there's something about the travel calls that aren't called that makes fans okay, because it feels like now it's a part of the game and everybody sort of understands it. And invariably, by the way, the end of those traveling moments are these incredibly, you know, artistic, balletic baskets, right. And I think everybody's okay with that. Nobody travels in any other way except essentially on layups or jams, and it just seems to be a metamorphosis of that particular rule, that metamorphosis that feels like it elevates the game rather than detracts from it, if that makes sense.
When did it go from being a soccer ball to a basketball? When was the basketball invented?
The basketballs, that's not often the, you know, I would say a basketball for the sport was actually invented within about 6 or 7 years. Almost all the big equipment manufacturer back then was Spalding. They were kind of the Albert Spalding was an early baseball player, and then he formed a sporting goods company. And you know, sports, the modern industrial complex of sports was basically being invented at this time. And so all of a sudden people started to make equipment specific, not just for general activities, but for specific sports like the basketball. And so I couldn't tell you the exact year, but I think by the late 1890s, again, extremely quickly, that's how quickly basketball spread, they were making balls that were specifically aimed at basketball. But the same thing happened with kickball. You know, everybody thinks we have kickball in the book, mostly it's really a childhood game, and it's played by adults but only in beer leagues. But we included it because everybody's played kickball as kids. It's kind of like checkers, and that red ball is so iconic, right? You know, the red kickball. But we found out actually that the red kickball wasn't really invented until about the 50s, and kickball had been around since a guy named Seuss invented it. He ran the playgrounds in Cincinnati, and he invented it in 1917. No relation to Dr. Seuss, by the way. And so that they used a soccer ball back then too. So sports, you know, the evolution of sports is also the evolution of sports equipment in a funny way that usually happens in tandem, but not quite in the ways that we think.
I once struck out in kickball. No, I didn't.
I once struck out in t-ball. So
we're speaking with Gary Beltsky. He's an author and an award-winning editor. He's the co-author with Neil Fine of On the Origins of Sports, the early history and original rules of everybody's favorite games. A short break, and we'll be right back.
And we're back with today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Of course, we're speaking with Gary Belsky about his co-authored book on the origins of sports, the early history and original rules of everybody's favorite games. Gary, let's talk about the organization and how the hockey sport became popular in Canada.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Hockey was actually a sport that combined two existing sports. One was hurling, which was an incredibly fast, incredibly compelling and slightly dangerous Irish sport with some version of proto lacrosse that was played by Native Americans and Native North Americans, really, because this was mostly happening in Canada. And this was in the sort of late 1700s, early 1800s, and most of the Westerners in Canada, or a lot of them, were British conscripts, and a lot of those conscripts were Irish, and they essentially combined their love of hurling with this game of lacrosse, whatever it was called. Some people thought it hockey might be a word that was used to describe the game, by the locals, and they combined it with early ice skating shoes, essentially, shoes with blades on them, and the sport of hockey was formed, and it very quickly took off in Canada when one of those conscripts moved to Montreal and started organizing games in that city, and the first rules were published, the first rules that survived were published in the late 1860s in the Montreal Gazette for a game that actually, in a funny way, was looked very different than it does today, not least because in the original days of hockey, you could only pass the puck backwards. You couldn't actually pass the puck forward. Mm-hmm. So that it was a little bit like rugby, like it took a long time for the game to sort of evolve into the one we know now.
I want to go to baseball because I bet some of our listeners think it was invented by Abner Doubleday because there are a lot of people that do. So if you would first talk about that and then talk about some of the ways it's changed. They're amazing. There are a lot of ways that it's evolved.
Yeah, Americans love a good myth story, even if it's not true. And one of the, I think you're right, by the way. I think if you ask most people who invented baseball, most of them would say Abner Doubleday, who was a Union general from Cooperstown, New York, who had, as far as we know, absolutely nothing to do with the invention of baseball, not least because it was invented in England, which I'll get to in a second. But the reason why people think Abner Doubleday invented baseball is because in the late 1890s, early 1900s, that sporting goods company that I referred to, the Spalding Company, was run by a guy named Albert Spalding, who really wanted to make people believe that baseball, which he played as a young man, was, he wanted to sell gloves and bats and balls and shoes, and so he wanted to sort of create this kind of idea of an American-only sport. And he established something called the Mills Commission, which was meant to sort of look seriously into the history of baseball. And they looked so seriously that basically they received a letter from another guy named Abner who told them this story about Abner Doubleday, sketching out the baseball diamond in the dirt streets of Cooperstown. This Abner, by the way, it turns out it spent a lot of time in a mental asylum. I'm not kidding about any of this. The story was completely fabricated. And Abner Doubleday, by the way, was a good guy. He was a Union general. Don't be mad at him. But they just started telling this story about Cooperstown, New York, being the birthplace of baseball. It's significant, by the way, that the Hall of Fame, which was established in Cooperstown, New York, right, because of all of this, doesn't have Abner Doubleday as a member. He's not in the Baseball Hall of Fame because for around the world, there were lots of stick and ball games, but the people were hitting rocks or petrified animal dung with sticks of all kinds for several thousand years. And in England, they had a particular kind of stick and ball game, which basically involved sort of running back and forth between bases, between markers, as opposed to hitting a ball into a goal or hitting a rock into a goal with a stick. And there were many versions of that, three of which survive today. One is cricket. One is rounders, which is played by people in England, and the other is baseball, which was referenced in several different English books and poems in the 1700s and possibly even earlier. They were talking about baseball in England before people were playing it in America. And what happened was, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but North America was settled by English people. And so, shock of shocks, they brought their games here. And one of the games they brought was baseball, and it very quickly took off more than cricket, more than rounders, who knows why. And very soon, there were all these competing versions of the game. People played many sports by local rules. And as modernity allowed people to travel and play each other in different physical activities, there would often be these fights about whose rules are we playing by. And ultimately, the Knickerbocker Baseball Club in New York, which had some cachet as kind of the best team in the biggest city, said, if you want to play us, you're going to have to play by our rules. And those are the rules that we used in our book. There's an argument to be made that those rules were published, I think, in 1848. About 19 years later, there was a convention in New York between a lot of different baseball clubs that made the rules even more familiar to us today. But we like the Knickerbocker rules because they're so famous, and it would have seemed weird not to include them.
And this Elysian Fields business, where the field backed up against the river, which made a home run not a good thing to do.
Yeah, there were, in the early days of baseball, so, you know, a lot of home runs, something that we would consider a home run would actually be considered a foul ball, because you basically didn't want to lose the ball and hit it against into the Hudson. Most of the baseball games that the Knickerbocker team played were played in New Jersey. They would, which is why some of the rules in the early versions of baseball talk about not being late to the game and not canceling, because nobody wanted to row a boat across the Hudson to play baseball and then find out that the other team had bailed. And so, again, this is a perfect example of a lot of these rules were written for people to deal with problems that they were having. It's funny that you talk about, one of the most interesting, if you'll allow me to filibuster for a second, one of the most interesting aspects of all of these rules is the idea that they were meant to settle disputes, that increasingly as colleges were playing each other, as schools were playing each other, as towns or parishes or even nations were starting to play each other, that was the issue, was how do we resolve disputes? And so one of the most basic aspects of all sports, which is the halftime break, which we just sort of think like, well, of course they take a break at the half. That actually wasn't necessarily something that was obvious. It happened because in England, there was a big dispute between how you play, they called it football, but how one plays soccer. Does one only kick the ball, or does one kick the ball and also handle it with one's hands? And this dispute was so sort of vicious and impassioned that ultimately it caused a split into soccer and rugby. But before that split, one of the ways they would settle these disputes between two parishes, say, was to stop halfway through the game, take a break, and then start using the other side's rules. And that's where halftime came from.
Because, that is so interesting.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Well, it's like a designated hitter when the World Series... Okay, Joe. All right, we do have to go.
I don't even know what Joe's face making, but I'm with Joe.
We have to hit a break.
If you meant it's like the designated hitter, a completely ridiculous rule, then yes.
Yes. All right, Gary Felsky, author, award-winning editor, founding partner of the editorial consulting firm Elland Road Partners, along with Neil Fine. He's written several books. This one is on the origins of sports, the early history and original rules of everybody's favorite games. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Love the show.
Thank you. Food and Dining is next. And welcome back to Food and Dining on today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. Are we ready for Thursday's Food and Dining?
I certainly am.
Well, joining us, chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gassenheimer. Today's edition looks at a way to not only curb the proliferation of a non-native aquatic predator, but to perhaps gain some fine dining.
A predator.
Linda, you'll have to take us through this.
Well,
here we go.
Sure will. I mean, what are we talking about? We're talking about lionfish. It's a very colorful fish, It has a voracious appetite. And they themselves are predators. And they can destroy our whole local fish population without any question about that. And there's not much we can do about curbing them except perhaps selling them commercially. And now Whole Foods Markets throughout the state of Florida is doing just that. And to tell us more about this lionfish is David Ventura. He's the Whole Foods Regional Seafood Coordinator. Let's welcome David.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you for having me. We're very grateful to be part of your show. Thank you.
Well, we're happy to have
you. Are these things like piranha or something?
No.
Joe. Well, also with us is Yasmani Perez. He's the Whole Foods Associate Store Team Leader, and he creates recipes for lionfish. And we love him because he brought food for us to taste. So let's welcome Yasmani.
Hello, Linda. How are you? Thank you for having me here today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for coming. Of course, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Have you either caught or had a chance maybe to eat lionfish? Do you have any questions or suggestions for our guests? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
Or radio at WLRN.org is our email.
Right. And of course, our favorite wine guy is with us, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype. Fred writes the wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes columns that you can read in the Miami Herald. And you can also read his wine column. It's Saturdays in the Miami Herald food section. Fred, what are we drinking today?
Where there is fish, there has to be wine, and I'm going to take care of it.
I'm sure you will. Thank you, Fred Tasker. David Ventura, first of all, you know, how did this lionfish invasion start, and why have they become so invasive?
Well, it's been brought to our attention that it was brought here by the aquarium industry, of all things.
And it was had, like, little fish in their aquarium?
Exactly. And they would go home, go to work every day, and when they would come home, they would find there would be less and less fish left in the tank. So finally, they discovered that the lionfish were eating all the other fish in their aquarium tank.
So they got rid of them. They put them in the canals?
Well, what happened was I believe they, obviously a lot of people were upset and they went back to the store, and the store obviously made good on the purchase, and they obviously released them into the ocean.
The pet stores did?
It's been brought to our attention that
That's what happened.
Hmm. That's what happened, yeah.
But they've multiplied so quickly. How does that happen?
Well, the female at the age of 1 year old, she is capable of laying every 2 to 3 days 30,000 to 40,000 eggs.
Wow.
For a total of 2 million eggs per year.
And that's one fish, and there's no predator because they have these big spines that are sort of venomous.
Correct. They do have 18 spines that are venomous, and in our waters, there is no native predator for the lionfish, correct? You're absolutely correct.
Wow. But now I understand the meat's very tasty because we have some here and we're eating it. Now, does this venomous spine have anything to do with the meat itself?
Absolutely not. The meat is totally, totally safe to eat. I've eaten myself various ways. I've had it in the form of sushi, ceviche, fish tacos, which we're going to have today. And I've also eaten it pan sautéed. So it's very versatile.
Just like regular fish.
Absolutely.
And you know,
it's
when
very
I,
versatile.
Is it? And this has made us this wonderful fish taco here. So, but I just wanted to ask you another question. Humans are really the only predators for this fish, is what you're saying. And they have to be speared. So how are you selling at the market if you can only spear these fish? How can you spear enough of it?
Well, again, how we started was we started back in March. And our adventure took us down to the Keys, and we started to partner with a lot of the local fishermen that we currently do throughout the state of Florida. And I had a nice opportunity to meet a diver, and she educated me on the process, how they have to dive anywhere down to as deep as 150 feet.
Wow.
And what they do is they catch them one by one, but spear caught, and they bring them up, and then we have a distribution system, and we purchase them through the divers throughout the state of Florida.
Why can they only be caught gotten with a spear?
Well, currently, that is the only way that they can be harvested because of regulation. They do like traps, for example, but right now there isn't a trap that will meet regulation because the concern is bycatch, you know, so we don't want to have a lot of bycatch because at Whole Foods Market, you know, our mission is to move the seafood industry to greater sustainability. creating healthy ecosystems, reversing overfishing and bycatch.
When by bycatch, you mean...
Meaning when you, other fish.
Correct. Correct.
They'll catch other fish that they don't want and they just throw them out even though they die or they don't use them.
Correct. That's absolutely a big concern. You know, it's one of our core values at Whole Foods Market is to be the stewards of the environment. And the lionfish, they're not playing nice. You know, they're going against everything we're trying to accomplish. They're damaging the coral reef and they're eating all the species that are native to Florida. And how they damage the coral reef is they actually eat the fish that are the cleaners of the algae. And because the algae is left uncontrolled, the coral reef are dying. The coral reef is dying.
So not only are they ruining our fish population, they're ruining the coral reef, the whole ecosystem.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The whole ecosystem. We have a caller here.
Well, maybe it would be, maybe we could leave alone the more endangered fish and start fishing more for the lionfish.
Well, it also seems that spearing these things one by one is making a very small impact on the total population that are predators of the other fish.
Correct. That's a very good point. The Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission have told us there's millions of those fish in our waters currently. Huh. The first fish was spotted actually in Dania Beach by a diver in 1985. And from 1985, they spread as far north to Rhode Island and in the Atlantic Ocean and as far south as
Brazil. So it's destroying the population up and down the East Coast.
Absolutely. It's not just Florida. It's very, very prevalent here in Florida. Because they love the warm water.
Right.
So they're not in the Pacific?
I don't know if... they actually originate from the Indian and Pacific Ocean. That's where they originally came from. Oh. That's where the aquarium industry purchased them from. But there's a total different circumstance over there. There's because of evolution, they have some predators. It's also brought to my attention there's a parasite that will attack the male lionfish. And what that parasite does, it renders the male sterile. So that's one form of controlling the population. Currently, that parasite is not in our waters, so that's a good or bad thing. Again, that's all depends on science, of course, because, again, you don't know when that parasite does catch up with species, what it's going to do to native species.
Right.
That's a big question mark.
Yeah. Well, if you can't eat them, you can't beat them. We have to eat them. You can't beat them. We're going to eat them because we have somebody calling in.
Well, our motto.
We have Debbie.
What's your motto?
Our motto is take a bite out of the lionfish.
Okay, take a bite out of the lionfish. Debbie, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I just want you to know that I stopped by Whole Foods Market the other day, and I saw they had lionfish, and I made lionfish ceviche, and it was absolutely delicious.
So you had ceviche, which is...
Nice thing was that they cleaned them for you, so you don't have to worry about, you know, touching the actual outside of the fish, because Whole Foods cleaned them for you.
That's a very good point, Debbie. First of all, thank you for shopping Whole Foods Market. We appreciate it. All our team members are very well trained in the handling of lionfish and processing of the lionfish, as well as all the other species. And we also offer at no charge the processing of the fish for you. So that's something that we're very, very happy to provide our customers. So thank you for shopping Whole Foods.
So Debbie, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Well, we've been talking about eating them, and Yaz is sitting here, and he brought us fish to eat.
So yes, let me try this now.
Yeah, tell us what we're eating here.
Absolutely, Linda. So what I've prepared for you today is a great lionfish taco. It's marinated in lime juice and cilantro, pan-seared.
Mm.
And then what I served it with is a...
So you cook it and you marinate it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
Absolutely. And what I've paired it up with is a nice wasabi avocado dipping sauce.
And what's in that?
So that's just made with a nice plain Greek yogurt and a little bit of avocado, some cilantro, jalapeno, and then the wasabi.
It's really good.
Mm-hmm. It's delicious. And that recipe is at dinnerinminutes.com. We've got all the recipes. And we've got a recipe for ceviche up there as well that you gave us.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, and your caller called in and said that she was making ceviche. It's a great fish for ceviche. It's great for oven roasting, frying. I mean, it's got so many great applications. It's a very, very versatile fish.
Now, do you take these home as fillets or steaks or...
Yep, so we come into the stores. All of our great fishmongers are trained to clean them up and fillet them for you. So really, the only thing you have to do is just imagine what you're going to prepare with it. And anything that you really want to do with it, you're capable of doing with this fish, they're going to take care of all the dirty work for you right in the store.
And if you pan fry it, what's the best way to do that?
I'm a very big fan of Cajun blackening spice. Just a nice light coating, a little bit of olive oil, great sear on both sides, just finish it right in the oven, comes out perfect.
Okay. Well, and also, I'm eating this, and it's very, it's thick. It's very meaty. And I think you were telling me, David, that these are fat fish.
It's not a fat fish.
Not fat in the sense of oil fat, but
correct.
Thick.
Think of it as They can consume 45 to 50 fish a day or anything else. They actually, the only things they don't eat in the ocean are sea turtles, coral reef, and mammals. Everything else is on their diet.
But they can. How much fish a day?
They eat 45 to 50
fish
per
a day.
Per
and
day.
We're talking about millions of these
correct
fish
correct
doing that.
Correct. They have a ferocious appetite. They've eaten so much that scientists have, when they do an autopsy on their liver, they have found their liver is three times the size of normal, and they attribute that to the overeating that that's happening.
Isn't that unusual in nature for animals to overeat?
That's a good question. I don't have the answer to that one.
Okay.
That's a good question.
He hasn't talked to the fish lately, but he just sells them.
It seems like.
Right. They
He's not a biologist.
Right. I'm not a biologist.
They're spare caught. It's difficult to catch them and all. So what is the price of this fish? I mean, we're going to pay a lot of money for it?
Well, fortunately at Whole Foods Market, we feel that to create the market, which we have, we're selling ours everyday value at $9.99 a pound, whole fish. And then on occasion, maybe once or twice per month, we will sell it on sale, the whole fish, for $8.99 a pound. But I want to talk about the diver a little bit if I can.
Yes, you can. But I just wanted to come back to when you say whole fish, can I buy a fillet?
Yes, you could buy it also filleted, but most of our customers come in and they buy the whole fish and we will process it for them.
What do you mean? We buy the whole fish, then you'll fillet it?
Yeah, you pay for the whole fish and then you have it filleted
right,
for
right,
free.
Right, okay.
Right, because there's some customers that would like to take the whole fish home and they put it on the barbecue. They'll barbecue the whole fish. You know, there's plenty
with
of customers.
With the skin? Without the spine, though?
Well, yeah, we take off the spines for them.
And clean it.
And we clean it. And some will ask us to do certain things to it, and then whatever they want, we're happy to service their needs, and they'll take it home, they put it on their grill, and they'll barbecue.
Okay. Now, you wanted to talk about the divers.
Yes. Again, we've been doing business with the community for a long, long time, Whole Foods Market. It's very, very important for us. And I didn't have any contacts for lionfish. So the fishermen have introduced me to the divers, and the divers, I have to say, they are very, very unique, creative, hardworking people. I mean, they are very passionate about getting lionfish out of the water. I mean, they go down depths of 150 feet, and they do it in numerous times because there's only so much time they could go down there because of the oxygen and the air tanks and everything. But
so they don't come up much higher than that, or?
Well, actually, the lionfish have been spotted as deep as 900 feet. However, we don't have the capability going down there. Exactly.
A bathyscope.
Exactly. And the lionfish actually, they swim in like 200 to 300, a school of 200 to 300 at a time. Oh. They've been known to land on a certain reef, and within 4 to 6 weeks, they will wipe out 75% of the fish population on that reef.
Wow. Well, on that
note,
what
are we going to do?
Well, Whole Foods is trying to help us understand that
maybe
we need
restaurants
to do something.
Should start serving it as well.
Well, let's see what happens. Well, on that note, we're
I'm
going to take
sleep tonight.
On that note, it's time for a break. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. My guests today are David Ventura and Yasmani Perez. They're from Whole Foods Market in Florida. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. And we're talking about the invasive species lionfish with David Ventura, Whole Foods Regional Seafood Coordinator, and Yasmani Perez, Whole Foods Associate Store Team Leader. David's been explaining why this fish has become so dangerous to our environment. And Whole Foods is now selling the fish. And Yasmani has been talking how to cook lionfish and brought us wonderful fish to eat. But now it's dinner in minute time. So here's another fish recipe. And it's a fish fillet. I call it snapper parmesan with spinach penne pasta. But you could use lionfish for this recipe.
Right.
It's a 10-minute meal for sure. The fish fillets are topped with sliced tomatoes and melted parmesan cheese. So it's really easy. You make it in the broiler. First, you broil the fish for a few minutes on each side. Then I add some tomato slices and some parmesan cheese and melt that under the broiler for a minute. And it's done. It's really simple and easy. And for the spinach penne pasta, you just cook the penne in boiling water and add some spinach just at the end there so it wilts in the water, a little olive oil, and it's ready to serve. So, Joe, yes, it's 10 minutes. You can do it.
Maybe. Probably 15 or 20 for me.
Probably. Okay. So, anyway, the complete recipe and the photo can be found on my website, That's dinnerinminutes.com. And you can also find Yasmani's recipes for lionfish there is at dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred Tasker, what are we drinking?
Well, you know, I love the idea of eating lionfish. It's a chance to have a gourmet meal and save the planet at the same time. Of course, it brings up the crucial question of what wine to serve with it. Now, I haven't tasted lionfish, but I heard you folks talking about it, that it's considered delicate and mild and that sort of thing, and compared to grouper or snapper. And with a mild fish like that, I like to pair the wine not with the fish, but with the sauce it's cooked in. Now, Linda's, if you prepared it the way Linda did her snapper, it would be rich and buttery, so I'd go with an equally rich and buttery California Chardonnay, or even an expensive French white Burgundy.
Sounds good. Mm.
And now Yaz is mentioning sushi, and I think if you were making sushi of it, you could serve it with sake. And in fact, the taco with wasabi sauce also might go very nicely with sake.
Mm. Sounds fantastic, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
Alternatively, I like to, when I have a nice mild fish like lionfish, I like to simply dust it in cornmeal and saute it in butter. The most simple of possible ways of preparing it. And of course, with all fried
here
foods,
it comes.
The wine of choice is crisp, light, bubbly, sparkling wine.
What a surprise! Glad
that's
you got that
works.
In, Fred.
Have to do that. Now, grilled lionfish, on the other hand, would have those tasty, bitter grill marks, and that, I think, might even justify a light red wine, like a Pinot Noir. And you could also use a Pinot Noir if you cook the lionfish in a red wine sauce, and I think same light red wine would go well if you mentioned that blackened lionfish. Now, I saw a great recipe online. I was looking at the lionfish, and they had one for lionfish in a coconut curry sauce.
That sounds
just absolutely over the top. And I'd pair this with a sweet, extra-rich, vanilla-scented French viognier. Now I'm making myself hungry.
And us as well, Fred.
Now, finally, if you simply bake the lionfish and hit it with a squeeze of lemon juice, I'd serve a citrus-flavored Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand. So I think overall you could pair lionfish with wines the same way you would pair it with a grouper or a snapper. So fans, pig out and save the planet. Linda?
Just like lionfish do. Except
that's right.
they're
pigging
out and they're destroying the planet. Yes. Instead. David and Cheryl, what's been your customer reaction to this selling of the lionfish in the store? Have they come in to buy it?
That's a great question. When we first started in April, the first week of April, we tried three test stores, which were the Boca Raton, Fort Lauderdale, and Sarasota store. And the response was overwhelmingly positive. They are very, very in tune to it. They're very concerned about the environment. That's the number one motivation why they're coming in and buying the lionfish. And now that we have it in all 26 stores, we have been very successful with it. And the customers are very, very happy that we have it. Sometimes they're calling in, and because of the challenges sometimes with the weather and the diving community to get down there to compete with the weather conditions, we have a store might be out of stock. So they're actually leaving their names and their numbers for when it comes in for us to call them back. And
I was wondering about that. Is the venom of any danger to the diver?
Not that I'm aware of. They wear protective gear, but once again, I'm not a diver, so I would think that question would be posed best to the diver.
What about the customers? Do they express any concern about the venom?
They ask the question, and we'll give them the answer that the meat is not venomous.
And when they buy the whole fish, the spines are gone, so the skin might be on, but it's perfectly safe, is what you're saying.
Absolutely, and we'll trim and remove the spines for each order as it goes out.
Are there plans to increase your ability to catch more?
Yes, I've met with many, many people in industry, Florida Fish and Wildlife, for example. I've partnered with many of the people that we do business with in the fishing industry. I've also talked to people at NOAA about this.
Now, NOAA is the National Oceanic Atmosphere Administration.
Correct.
Right.
Very good.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah,
I
talked to our doctor.
I looked it up.
Dr. James Morris. He was very helpful, and he's very passionate, as many people are, about trying to control the problem. Mm. It's a big problem.
It sure is. And so that's when. So should we call the store to see if there's fish in before we go in?
Well, again, I would advise that if you're really passionate about serving it that particular night. But as a rule, we do have it in all our stores. We're working very hard. Interesting enough, I'm receiving calls from divers that have heard that we're doing this, and they want to do on the weekend. Their dive on the weekend,
and sell it too.
And they want to be able to harvest the lionfish because they're very passionate about getting it out of the water, like we are.
Well, this is so interesting, and it's been a very interesting and tasty week. I want to thank you, David Ventura, for joining us, and Yasmani Perez. Your fish taco here is just delicious. Thank you so much.
It really was. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda and team, for having us. We appreciate the opportunity.
Well, you can buy the lionfish at all the Whole Foods markets in Florida. Is that correct? At all the food markets?
All 26, correct.
And Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
I'm glad you got that bubbly in.
Yeah, me too.
Next week we'll be talking about a healthy take on Middle Eastern food with Zouk, executive chef, and co-owner Danny Ganim. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
Well, that wraps up today's edition of Topical Currents. We hope you enjoyed it. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Polly Landis is associate producer. Now, Bonnie, speaking of Paul Leary.
Yes, we'd like to take some time to bid farewell to Paul. He's moving on. This is his last day. Paul, why don't you open your mic?
Yes, come on with us.
I'm here.
So many people hear your name throughout the day, and now you can come on as Paul Leary.
It's your last day as the technical director of Topical Currents, and you were also our outstanding online producer for both our presence on the WLRN website.org website, as well as our Facebook page.
All those periscopes that he's been doing.
And yes, on many occasions, he took the initiative to stream Topical Currents live on Facebook and on Twitter, which was as much fun as it was well received and appreciated. And speaking of Twitter, he brought us into the 21st century using Twitter frequently, tweeting about our programs, and using the Twitter handles of our guests. So we're going to miss you, Paul. We're going to miss your ingenuity, your creativity, your sense of humor, and your professionalism.
Where will I go with all those questions, Bonnie?
I don't know. He was our go-to guy for all things technical.
My guru. He fixed everything for me on my phone. So, Paul, I really, really want to wish you good luck in whatever you do now.
Thank you. Thank you.
And come back and fix my
phone.
Paul,
I'm going to miss you, too.
Thanks, Fred.
And Paul, do come back and fix my phone once in a while. Okay?
But he also added so much to the program, like we'd be doing a pet show and he'd you know, pull out how much is that doggy in the window, whatever it is. But, Paul, we do congratulate you and we wish you well on your journey.
Thank you.
And we thank you for all your contributions and inventiveness throughout the year.
Thank you. 10 years, a long time.
I was going to ask how many years.
It's been 10 years, and I have loved every single minute of it. I'll miss you all. Thank you, Bonnie and Joe and Linda and everybody.
And Richard.
It has been an experience I'll remember forever. Thank you. I appreciate that.
We're going to miss you.
Well, our listeners have benefited quite a bit as well, Paul.
Don't be a stranger to us, though.
And that's what it's all about, right?
That's right. That has been the best part of it, connecting with the community and feeling like you're doing something for the community, for the listeners. That's the payoff right there.
Well, yeah. You've been a big part of us.
Yeah. Thank you so much. It's been an honor to be part of Topical Currents and WLRN. It's been a real honor.
We'll miss you, Paul.
Thank you.
Once again, our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Polly Landis is associate producer. And we have free audio archives for download at our website. That's WLRN.org. And also check out the Topical Currents Facebook page. We have photos, links, and much more information.
I didn't think it was that darn Linda Gassenheimer
recommended. Do you remember that? Did you hear that, Linda? Paul just put on.
Play it again.
Play it again.
I didn't pick it. It was that darn Linda Gassenheimer recommended it.
Oh, my God.
Nice. Yeah, very nice, Paul. Bye, Paul.
Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Linda Gassenheimer.
Fred Tasker.
We certainly want to thank you all. And tomorrow at 1, it's Science Friday and host Ira Flato. Longtime favorite program here on WLRN and Public Radio. And then Monday, Bonnie and I will return. You'll be with us Monday, of course. We'll be missing Paul on Monday.
Yes, we will.
Well, we'll return with Professor Walter Ben Michaels of the University of Illinois at Chicago. We're going to talk about his book, The Trouble with Diversity. And, of course, we'll be taking your calls. Once again, goodbye to Paul Leary. We think the world of you. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.
I didn't pick it. It was that darn Linda Gassenheimer recommended it.
Oh, my God.